Preservation Howard County is more than just keeping objects in good shape. It's a process that involves you.
It's involving people in the process of preserving our historic assets and being involved to the point of seeing these assets being preserved and in many cases given an adaptive life.
If you've ever considered volunteering for the Red Cross, but weren't sure if you had what it takes, there's only one qualification that they are looking for in your resume.
I would say passion. Passion to help. You know, there's a lot of people that really get a lot of satisfaction out of lending a hand to someone else. You know, we can teach you everything else.
These stories coming up in May's episode of HOCO Journal, starting right now. Hi, and welcome to HOCO Journal, the show where we highlight the unique and interesting people, businesses, nonprofit organizations, and events happening right here in Howard County. I am your host, Cris Oviedo. The American Red Cross has been helping people in the United States all over the world since 1881. Founded by Clara Barton with the purpose to help those in need, the American Red Cross has evolved through time, and it is now one of the largest volunteer-run organizations not only here in the United States but worldwide, aiding people from all backgrounds and all corners during disasters, big and small. To tell us more about this worthy institution, in studio with me today is Lenore Kors, and she is the Acting Regional Communications Officer for the Greater Chesapeake Red Cross. Welcome to our studio, Lenore.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Let's just start by telling people maybe what the Red Cross is.
The American Red Cross is the main purpose. We're here to alleviate suffering and prepare people for disasters. And that comes in many ways. We have a local chapter in each county. Then we're all part of a region, the Greater Chesapeake region. And then we're part of the American Red Cross. And then we're also a member of the International Red Cross. So I appreciate the opportunity to tell the story of the Red Cross because, as you said, so many people do not know all the different services that we provide. One of the main things that I always like to point out is the Red Cross is primarily volunteers. We are generally run by leadership volunteers. There is a support staff in every chapter, but the majority of the workforce is done by volunteers, which
wow.
I think is exciting. Also, we receive no government funding. We are totally dependent on the generosity of the community, so donations. And again, because Red Cross is called in on all the big disasters, mm-hmm. we actually are chartered by Congress to perform disaster response. Many people perceive that we receive some type of government funding.
Right.
Now, we do work in partnership with our government agencies and other nonprofits and not-for-profits. But we are totally dependent on the donated dollar and also the good work of volunteers. Before I came here today, I was notified of a multifamily fire up in Abington, Maryland, which is in Harford County. So our volunteers are there. The fire department was more than likely there first, and they call us in, and then we provide emergency assistance, whatever they may need. And the little fires, the single family fires, don't always make the big news, but they're just like a big disaster to that family.
Absolutely.
They are a Katrina to that family, if they've lost everything.
Absolutely.
So even though it might not be the big news flash story, it affects that family and even further out. And we work with them to meet their immediate needs, which could be anything from shelter, clothing, food, if they need housing. We also, if someone would need their medicines replaced or their glasses replaced, or any kind of essential medical need, we have volunteer nurses that can do that, you know, have it replenished through a system. You just can't walk back into the pharmacy and say, I need more of my medicine. We also have volunteer licensed mental health providers where they will come out. And if there's a need for it, and very often when there's a disaster, people are upset and they do need assistance. And then we have a casework team, mostly volunteers again, that will follow them through a total recovery plan. And we sometimes make referrals to other agencies, but we make sure they're back on their feet again and in good shape. So that's just one piece of the Red Cross that I think we're known for disaster response. But it's usually the bigger events that make the news. You know, the Katrinas, the Sandys, right. Even the international ones, which we do support here locally. Many of our volunteers will actually deploy to some of these locations, and they have to commit for a set period of time because of the training and travel. It's usually at least 2 weeks, if not longer.
Now, are travel expenses in those cases covered through the Red Cross?
Yes,
or is
they
that
are.
Also?
Yes, okay. They are. And sometimes they're donated by different entities that might get them there. But many of those volunteers, I know with the floods last year, the volunteers were staying in the shelters and they were sleeping on the floor or sleeping on cots with everyone else. So it's not, you're not going off to something, even when you hear it in a nice place, it could be very extreme situation, you know, hardship.
Right. So, right, absolutely.
So it's very committed volunteers, and we're always in need of more volunteers. So
it's amazing to me to find out that you guys are run mostly by volunteers, because one of the very first places every time there is a disaster, I mean, right underneath, I want to say always the government entities is the Red Cross. You know, it's the same, it's at the same level. So, but you did say that you guys partner with government. So what does that partnership look like? For instance, let's Ecuador. There was a big earthquake in Ecuador a year ago. In cases like that, how does the Red Cross partner with the government so you guys can assist? Or Katrina, how do you guys, you know, partner in order to assist?
Well, generally, there is, we're always in communication. In fact, to explain it simply, we have a seat at MEMA, which is the Maryland Emergency Center. In each jurisdiction, each county or city, there's always an emergency operations center, just like MEMA, and Red Cross always has a seat there. So we're present whenever those entities are activated. So when they're going around the room saying, what is the health department doing? What is transportation doing? They'll come to the Red Cross, and they'll either make request of the Red Cross, generally. We're generally asked to help, but you know, it might be sheltering, and I can give a very good example of that. We recently had Easter Sunday, we had a large apartment fire down in Baltimore, and it was 151 units.
Wow.
So all those families were displaced, and Baltimore City requested that we manage a shelter. They got the facility for us, and then our volunteers managed the shelter. They're all trained. We provided food, shelter. We did facilitate replacement of some medications and such. Mm-hmm. And that went on from Sunday to Wednesday. But we don't make those decisions. We work with our partners at their request. Generally, you know, it's just a good working wheel that you know, and we even exercise these disaster responses quite often also across the country, internationally. You know, so we're all prepared.
And so talking about that preparation, because when you say the word volunteer, I know many of our listeners might be like, oh, I didn't realize that. Maybe I don't want to look at the Red Cross necessarily in order to get assistance. But how do you guys deal with that when you have volunteers coming in? I mean, I know you said nurses, so probably I'd imagine that there's certain requirements depending on the position that you want to volunteer for. Mm-hmm. But you also said that you guys are all trained. Is there like a big training everybody has to attend?
Yes, there is. It's not group training. It is certain, depending on what volunteer position you're interested in. There's a process, of course. Many of the courses are online now, but I've been a volunteer for 17 years. I've been involved with the Red Cross for 17 years. And in my earlier years, we would go and take an actual classroom. And sometimes it would be a two-day class, or we might have a weekend-long training program so a lot of volunteers can get a lot of different training. But it's all provided, free of charge. Most is online, not all. I'd say my guess would be probably 80 to 90% is online. And I will say that I believe, statistically, most people's interest when they come to the Red Cross to volunteer is usually to help in a disaster. You know, locally, small, fires, mm-hmm. any type. But most people seem to want to help. That's what brings them to us. That's not exclusive. There's many volunteers. We have a lot of volunteers that teach CPR and first aid, babysitting classes. We have just general internships. We do have just general office volunteers. We have volunteers that work with our service to the armed forces, which I can get into a little bit more about that. And we have an unbelievable amount of volunteers that work on the blood drives. And generally that's in the canteen now, but, you know, making sure that the donors that are waiting to give blood and after blood are comfortable and have what they need. It's quite a troop of volunteers in every Red Cross chapter, and especially in ours.
Absolutely. We talked about disaster relief, yep. But you said that is only one.
That's one, yes.
So let's talk about more of
okay.
what the...
One of the areas that a lot of people aren't familiar with is our service to the armed forces, which has existed for a very long time, from the very beginning, as a matter of fact. And some of the things that we provide are messaging. So if someone's spouse or loved one is somewhere else, and usually it might be, you know, an international assignment, mm-hmm. and they have an emergency back home, which could be someone ill, someone passing away, even a birth, or, you know, anything that is a major mm-hmm. family need. We are generally the one that is responsible for messaging. Now, I will say it has changed a little bit with the new technology.
Right.
But we also are the department that can verify things. So if someone here locally says that such and such has passed away, mm-hmm. and we need my brother to come back from overseas,
right.
we are the verifying organization for the military. We have that responsibility. We also, if a member of the military needs some type of loan, there is a loan program through the military, but we are the ones that facilitate it for them. So in other words, it's not coming out of our budget,
right.
it's coming out, but we have to verify everything that's being said. So the Red Cross has a big role for whenever there's a casualty. Very often Red Cross services are offered if they're needed. There's a lot of services that we do on all the military bases, and of course Maryland has quite a few.
Mm-hmm.
We have volunteers that on some of the bases might be dental hygienist. They're trained, but they're volunteers, and they come under the Red Cross umbrella. Of course, canteen, refreshments, things like that. But there are some that are very, very skilled, medical assistants and things of that nature on the bases. And it varies base by base and the need and what is done on those bases, because not every base has the same services.
Right.
But many people do not know that the
right.
Red Cross is heavily involved with the military and all lines of military service.
Right. Internationally as well?
As well, yes, that is correct. Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow.
So, and then another health and safety classes, which most people do understand that the Red Cross provides, but CPR, first aid, AED training, babysitting training, and there's all types. There's more specialized, like lifeguard training and such, where you need a certification. Then we also are a big provider of workplace CPR and first aid that is required. So we work with companies where they might sign up to send X amount of their employees to a class or have one of their employees trained to be a trainer at their place of employment. So more and more that's common, that workplaces have trained individuals for these type of emergencies, especially CPR, first aid, and AED. So again, that's another big part of what Red Cross does. Many of our instructors are volunteers also. Not all, but many are. And that's, again, that's a big part of what we do. And then, of course, I think most people think of us when they think of blood donations.
Absolutely. And
I'm
so
glad. And, of course, that's the gift of life. I could tell stories all day about the need for blood. And generally, one unit of blood can save three lives. And I believe here in our service area, we're responsible for supplying about 40% of the blood products to the hospitals. And you'll hear, on TV, radio, that there's a shortage at certain times of the year, which are traditionally during the holiday season when people are busy and don't quite think about that. And then also during the summertime when people are on vacation. And there's usually a shortage. And it's not that there's not blood on the shelves, but if there was a massive accident or some type of catastrophe, there might not be enough. Or there could be a shortage of a particular type of blood where they'll put out an appeal for that. But we work very hard to, recruit the volunteers, schedule the blood donation events, and then we also do all the regulated by the FDA processing of the blood to make sure the blood supply is safe before it even goes out into the medical field where it would be used.
So what happens? Let's talk. Let me stop you there for a minute and let's talk about that, because I've actually attempted to donate blood before, but my iron level has been low. So when and Howard Community College actually has many blood drives, or regular blood drives, I should say, throughout the course of the year. And I invite everybody to look at our calendar at howardcc.edu. I know there's one in May. I don't have the date with me, but there's one coming up in May. And if you miss the May one, there will be more upcoming. I know that for a fact. But so let's just walk listeners who maybe are hesitant. Maybe they don't like needles.
Right.
Right? But they would like to donate blood. Let's walk them through what that experience is like.
Well, we do ask everyone to register, because we don't like people to wait, because everyone's time is important. So there is a online way to register. So it cuts down on a lot of the paperwork that you can remember from a few years ago. And then there is an opportunity. You have to meet with one of the medical professionals to go over the health assessment. And I do believe that the donation process, speaking of needles and such, has come a long way, just like so many other medical procedures. Our phlebotomists are well trained. They try to be as gentle as possible. But also the tools that are used for blood drawing, they've come a long way in the recent years. The issue of not being eligible or being deferred, general, that is not a Red Cross rule, number one. That's a FDA rule. But there are some things that you can do to increase your ability to be able to donate. One is, of course, drinking lots of fluids. And that's also helpful for you, because your blood will flow easier. You'll complete your donation quicker. There's also some foods that I can't say off the top of my head, but there are some other rules about travel. Again, that is a government-imposed rule. So you should probably know that before you even attempt. And I believe it's on our website that, you know, if you've traveled within this amount of time to any of these countries, you will be deferred. Now, that doesn't mean we don't want you at all. We would like you to come back when that time period has passed. Right. So, you know, what the main thing is, we want a safe blood supply for the community, because it could be one of us that need that blood at any time. The main two uses of blood are, of course, surgeries, and a lot of times it's from accidents, and then cancer patients. And that's another thing. Some people can donate just platelets. So it's a process that goes through, but you're not giving all, you know, you're not giving a whole pint of your blood. They're just taking your platelets. And that is life-saving for people that need those platelets. Mm-hmm. I've actually known someone that had a couldn't create her own platelets. Or she did, but she had an autoimmune disease that would kill her platelets. And it's life-saving.
Absolutely.
It really is the gift of life.
Absolutely.
So, as I said, I think most people are familiar with our blood program, but maybe not knowing all the modern day type things. If you gave blood 5 years ago, it's very different today. It's a lot more streamlined. I think it's a lot more pleasant. And of course, there's always the pleasant volunteers at the end with a snack. And of course, there's a purpose to that. They want you to get fluids back in, and they want you to have something on your stomach. So, but they're just being nice also. But, you know, our neighbors need us. So a healthy quantity of blood on the shelves is very important for any type of an emergency.
So what happens after people come and donate blood? So where does that go? How do you guys distribute that, or where do you house it? How does that process work?
So there is the Greater Chesapeake Blood Region. It's located in Baltimore, and it actually serves an even bigger area than the Greater Chesapeake Region. So all blood donations are transported to the facility in Baltimore, which it is a secured medical lab for definition. And it goes through an extensive processing, testing that is regulated by the FDA. And then it is distributed to hospitals by request on what they need, what type they need, how much they need. And we distribute down into Virginia, down into Washington, D.C., all over the state of Maryland, and I think some into Pennsylvania also. So it is quite a, it's almost a manual manufacturing plant like type scenario. You take the blood, it goes in for the processing, and most importantly, the testing, packaging, labeling. It's all dated. Everyone knows where it came from. It's all tracked electronically. And then it's distributed to the hospitals.
Testing. What kind of testing does it go through?
I can't speak to that. I'm not a medical person, but I know that they're testing for any type of diseases, any type of anything that could be harmful to the recipient of the blood.
And, you know, I think that speaks volumes, because when you go to sign up for donating, there's a list of questions there in order to determine whether you are eligible or not to donate, because some people are not eligible for various reasons. It's interesting to hear now that not only the Red Cross goes by the questionnaire, but they also do that extra testing.
Yes.
You guys go that extra step to ensure that the blood that you guys are receiving and that you guys are giving out is blood that can be used safely for those who are going to receive it. So I personally appreciate that quite a bit.
I mean, it's first and foremost a safe blood supply. Also, I believe you're asked, when you're signing your paperwork, let's say even if it's electronic, would you like to be notified if there's anything found? So you can choose to be notified if there's anything found wrong. And I'm not sure, again, to what level that is, what those are. But, you know, it can serve a multi-purpose. You may not be aware that there's something
of
concern.
Now, you just explained to us that you guys supply blot to the greater Chesapeake area, and we went over which areas that cover. But if, for instance, you know, let's go back to like Katrina, and thankfully Katrina was not one where we lost a lot of lives. We lost a lot of things,
right,
but we didn't really have lives that were lost. But in an event where something like that happened and actual lives were lost, and there was not enough supply in the chapter or the area that covers that, do they then reach out to you guys for
Absolutely.
More?
Absolutely. And that's the same way we work as a disaster too. So if there's a catastrophic incident where there's many people injured.
And knocking on wood, that's not going to happen.
The local community cannot provide enough through whatever means they have.
Right.
There's a system, but we call it on appeal. They will appeal to all the appropriate other blood centers that to ship blood into those areas. And that is done. I don't know how common it would be, but it's done when there's these big incidents.
Right.
So if there was a big catastrophic train accident or something where there were many people injured at one time, that could be something.
Okay.
You know, I'm trying to think off the top of my head, you know, something like a plane crash where there's a lot of people. But anytime it's needed, the Red Cross is a system. It's one Red Cross also, the blood program and the disaster services, the service armed forces. We call ourselves one Red Cross, so we're always in communication, and many different forms of communication, of course, electronics, one of them. But whenever there is any type of major appeal, incident, activity, there's usually daily calls. So the appropriate people are on. There is in Washington, D.C., where our headquarters is, there's an emergency response center there, EOC, Emergency Operations Center. And again, that gets activated whenever there's something at a certain level. Mm-hmm. But they are aware, headquarters is aware of every fire we have, whether it's the small one or the big, or any incident, any disaster, not just fires. Fires are the most common. That's what it seems to come out, you know, that much. But it could be any disaster incident.
So you guys treat every disaster, no matter what the size of it is, with the same seriousness and the same commitment, really, it sounds like.
Well, there's a couple things that you might not relate to Red Cross that I can share just as an example that most people wouldn't understand. There was recently an unfortunate shooting up in Delaware, which is part of our service area. And the shooter had barricaded himself in a house. And so none of the community could go into their home for over a day. So we set up a shelter at the request of the local government. And we helped those families that couldn't get into their home. And I can remember years ago, and I don't want to date myself, it might have been 10 years ago or something like that, there was something on the east side of Baltimore County, Palzinski, it was the same exact thing, where there was someone that had barricaded themselves with weapons. No one could go in their home, and we had a shelter for days for those displaced. And, you know, they're worried about their pets. They're all of that. And we provide them the same services. If they had to leave their house, if they left in the morning and couldn't get back in and didn't have their meds, didn't have whatever it is they need, don't have clothes, we can provide them with, you know, emergency clothing, emergency, you know, medicine, of course, food. Very often when there is a shelter, we're generally always providing food and nourishment for them.
So. How important is to know that there are those services? I personally always thought the Red Cross was just basically like a blood bank. That's how I thought of it. And then, like I said, I learned that you guys not only work locally, but internationally as one. And I want to go ahead and transition into that, because you did say that you guys are the American Red Cross, but you guys belong to the International Red Cross.
Correct.
So Is there a real distinction there, or is that just, I guess, to be politically correct? I mean, is it just one organization, or is it in fact two separate organizations that just come together?
Well, the American Red Cross is a member of the International Red Cross. So most countries do have a Red Cross, not all, but most do. And, you know, it depends on what is needed. They do ask for volunteers sometimes to come, you know, an earthquake or something like that, a tsunami. But it also, that also goes, those requests go through our national headquarters. So if we here locally have someone that wants to volunteer, we won't sign them up and put them on a plane and send them to, you know, to the disaster area. We will forward their information on to, you know, our headquarters, our International Services Department at our headquarters in D.C., and they will facilitate the transportation. It's all done to be practical. In other words, getting people there at the most economical way and, you know, making sure they're healthy and qualified and trained and such. So we are a member. We're a supporting member of the International Red Cross.
So in cases, you know, where, like you said, an earthquake or a tsunami or something, and somebody contacts you guys and is like, oh, I want to go, you know, my family's from there, for instance, from where this tsunami just happened, and I want to go and assist and I want to go and help. How do you guys tell, like what's the process of you guys forward that information to your headquarters, but that's what's the process in actually making sure, I guess, that this person is qualified in order to go and actually assist? Because many, and I think many of us are driven and want to help, mm-hmm. but we are not prepared.
Right.
We're not prepared because you, when you're talking about a disaster zone, we're not ready to right. go and see the kind of things that we're going to be exposed to.
Correct.
Smells, mm-hmm. looks, you know,
mentally.
Exactly. I mean, we're just, you know, maybe physically and mentally prepared. We're not to go and deal with something like that. So how do you guys channel that?
Well, there is training, just like there is the training for being a local responder. There's training for everything, you know, training to be a CPR and first aid instructor. So you would start at the lower level and learning how to respond to a disaster here in our community. Mm-hmm. And there's actually leadership within the volunteer cadre. So you start taking management coursework. And as I said, a lot of this is online now. And then there is training to become international. And I'm sure, I have not taken that training myself, but I'm sure it covers all the areas that you've mentioned.
Language, you know, that's a big barrier that many times it comes into play.
Yes, it does. And mentally, I think, is a big one. I remember years ago, again, I've been involved with the Red Cross for quite a while, they would only allow you to deploy to a American Red Cross disaster for 3 weeks. Even if you wanted to stay longer, generally, they made you come back because you need that rest. You need that physical rest. You need that mental rest. Mm-hmm. And very often, they will also offer you and suggest that you speak with one of our mental health providers, which, again, are generally, they're licensed, but they're volunteers.
Right.
Because it's important. You see a lot, you know, you work hard. They're not 8-hour days. They're generally 12-hour shifts, sometimes 10-hour shifts, but usually 12-hour shifts. So it's a hardship generally. And when we ask for volunteers for a specific deployment, we will stress whether it is a hardship or not a hardship. And that might be defined by whether or not you have to sleep in the shelter, whether you're carrying everything you own on your backpack, because mm-hmm. most people aren't going in and staying in nice hotels.
Right. And I actually would like to go a little personal here and ask you, Lenore, if you have been involved in any of the situations, either locally or internationally, where you've had to go and assist during a disaster or, I mean, I know you said mm-hmm. that you had a fire, but like, so what do you do? Do you stay behind the scenes or are you actually going to the sites and helping people firsthand?
Sure. I have been trained to go in and interview the clients and take their information, do their damage assessment. I have done a small portion of that, but my track when I got started became into public relations. So very often I'm what is called the public information officer on the scene. So if the media would come, if anyone would come and want to talk, number one, privacy is so important for our clients. They have to agree to speak with someone. And we often are the mediator between that. So that is kind of where my focus has gone personally. And I do that quite often. Sometimes it's about the good things that the Red Cross is doing. Like this past weekend, we have a program nationally. It's called the Home Fire Campaign. And we have a very bold goal of trying to decrease the numbers of fires, home fires. And we have a partnership with multiple sponsors that donate the funds for free smoke detectors. And they are the modern smoke detectors that have a 10-year battery. Mm-hmm. And we partner with our sponsors, but also our local fire departments, where we go out and canvass high-risk neighborhoods, high-risk for fires, and knock on the door and ask whether they have a working smoke detector. Can we check their smoke detector? And that's where the fire department's with us also. And then if they don't have a working smoke detector, or if they don't have adequate ones, or if they're located in the wrong place, we will actually install them. And we just did that Saturday in a community, Joppa Magnolia, up in Harford County. And, you know, we would work in teams of 3 to 5 people. And we had a ladder, we had a drill gun, and we had smoke detectors. And the goal is to have a smoke detector on every level. And I can tell you most people don't realize that. And one of the houses we visited had the smoke detector in the kitchen. Well, that's not where it's suggested to be, because you end up, you know, activating them when right. you don't want to. You want them away from that stove and oven where they really will go off and wake someone up. And we are tracking how many saves we have because of that. And I'm familiar with 2 so far that I'm familiar with. I'm sure there's more, but people that have said because of the smoke detector the Red Cross and the fire department has installed for free, they got out. And you only have 2 minutes to get out. And we're also distributing educational materials, just basic things like the 2 minutes to get out, but also a dry erase board for the family to work together to have an escape plan. Everybody knows how important it is to all meet in one place and things of that nature. But it's magnetic. It has a little dry erase marker, and that way they work as a family, so the children know, the parents know what the children know.
And how important then that is, because yes. I mean, we are used to carrying our lives on a regular basis, but if we have not talked about what to do when and if at any point there is an emergency, then we're left in darkness, basically.
Yes, it's critical. It really it could save your life and save your family's life. And as I said, 2 minutes, that's not a long time.
No, not at all.
And if it's in the middle of the night, you know, when people are asleep, if you're multiple floors, you do have to have a plan. So I personally have been on the disaster team, going out and helping the clients, doing their paperwork and finding out what their needs are. And I've also done what we call mass care. That's provide the food in the shelters. And I've emptied the trash bags in the shelters. I've done all kinds of things. And that's what the volunteers do. And I think I get more out of it than the recipient. It gives me a lot of satisfaction. And I think every volunteer you would talk to would say the same thing.
So before we close, just a couple of things that I want to ask you are, for people who are listening and maybe considering to become a volunteer, what would you say is the most important thing that a person who wants to volunteer needs to have?
I would say passion. Passion to help. You know, there's a lot of people that really get a lot of satisfaction out of lending a hand to someone else. You know, we can teach you everything else. If you come in with passion, if you come in with wanting to help, if you're a donor and you want to make a financial donation, that comes from your passion. But we can teach you everything else. And sometimes people will see a need or see something on TV and they'll say, well, I want to go do that. Mm-hmm. It's not always a perfect fit, but we'll work with you to make sure you find something that does fit. You know, I mean, someone just volunteered and made a video for us. We have volunteer photographers, all kinds of things. And it's sometimes people come for resume building because they didn't get to do this type of thing. They're doing a different type of job. I'll use an example, an accountant that wants to be a photographer. And, that, you know, that's far-fetched. But my point is it gives you an opportunity to do what you like to do, what your passion is. I would say generally there's always a space, you know, there's always a need for someone. But it's a wonderful place. The mission is wonderful. I can't say enough about the volunteers giving of their time, talent, and treasure. And, you know, it all started with Clara Barton. So we're very pleased to be carrying out, you know, the mission from over 100 years ago. So
over 100 years of serving. Yes. If anybody is interested in finding out more information, where can they go?
They can go on our website. And depending on where you live, you might have a chapter, but the Greater Chesapeake region has a website, www.redcross.gcr. Or they can call our headquarters office, which is 410-624-2000, and just select the volunteer office, and they'll get you started.
Lenar, is there anything else that we haven't talked about that you'd like your listeners to know?
Well, one thing I don't think I touched on messaging for the military, but we also, in this digital age, it's not as critical, but when there are tragedies and big incidents, sometimes cell phones don't work. So you should always have a plan with your family, you know, a third party to communicate with. But we also still do messaging. I know during Katrina, that was a really big deal. Family members couldn't find out about their loved ones. I heard so many stories about parents not being able to find out about their college students. So we even have an app for that, and you can look on our website. You can download the Red Cross app. It has all kinds of information, but we do messaging when someone can't be found. You know, if there is an incident, there has to be confidentiality, but let's say there's a tragedy with a train or a plane or something like that, we will very often be asked to be the in-between conduit to put the two together. But there's a lot of confidentiality rules that go with that.
Right.
So the messaging is important for the military, but it's also something that can happen in any instance. And again, I think that's one of the things that a lot of people don't know about. And it's not one of the things that happen often, but it can.
Right.
It can. Think about all the tragedies that we know about and see on the news. So.
Right. Absolutely. It definitely can happen. It's a great opportunity, the Red Cross, to volunteer, to help out. If you've always wanted to make a difference, well, it can be as simple as just going and donating blood.
Yeah.
You know, that's giving life right there. That's saving a life.
You could say, yep.
Or you can do more, like Lenore was saying, I mean, a video photography, if you are more of the artistic inclined type of person, or if you want to go through the training and be ready to assist in the case of an emergency, you can do that as well.
And we do have internships too. So, you know, we try to fit the criteria for what the students need, but we do offer internships based on a good fit. But we do always need volunteers. We depend totally on the community for our support financially with our workforce and such, and appreciate the opportunity to tell our story.
Oh, thank you for coming to our studio, Lenore. I really appreciate it. And for HOCA Journal, I am Cris Oviedo, and we'll be right back.
When is the best time to talk to your family about staying in touch during a disaster? Amid the chaos? Or is the best time perhaps today? Go to ready.gov/communicate and make your emergency plan today. Don't wait. Communicate. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
For HOCO Journal, I'm Alex Baker. The mission of Preservation Howard County is to actively pursue the preservation of the historical and cultural heritage of Howard County. With me here today to talk about Preservation Howard County is their president, Fred Dorsey. Fred, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So first question we'll just sort of start off with is just give us a brief description of what Preservation Howard County is.
Preservation Howard County is a nonprofit organization that is an advocate, a voice for the historic preservation assets and creating an awareness of our non-renewable historic assets in the county. It was founded in 2000. It came out of a group of Howard County residents who were brought together to participate in a project called United Vision. They were to come up with a vision for Howard County in 2020. Mary Catherine Cochran was a member of that that group, and out of that project, it was made clear that there was a lack of any organization dealing with historic preservation. So at that time, Mary Catherine Cochran took upon herself to found Preservation Howard County.
And so what are some of the sites around Howard County that you've already helped preserve that are preserved now because of your work?
Right off of Route 100 in the area where Bob's breakfast is, there was a historic manor house, Montjoy, and several outbuildings. We prevailed upon Winchester Homes to delay the demolition of the building, and it allowed us to have a historic barn disassembled, stored, and subsequently it was delivered to Howard County Conservancy, where it was reassembled and it's used as their educational building. The actual manor house and the slave and kitchen quarters were sold to a private owner who has restored it. In Daisy, there was a one-room schoolhouse that was going to be demolished. We coordinated with a preservation company to disassemble, and that schoolhouse has been delivered out to the Farm Heritage Museum to be put back together. We participated in the restoration of the Pew Fulton House in Ellicott City, St. Charles Seminary ruins, Christ Church, and also St. Louis, the original St. Louis Church.
Wow. So I bet when, you know, when you've helped preserve something that was originally planned to be demolished and, you know, you're able to preserve it in, you know, to something like with the examples you've given, I must imagine it feels really good to do that.
It does. It not only is a good feeling for our board members who participated in the projects, but also for the builders and the organizations that had control of these buildings to be able to see that they were going to be preserved and in many cases used in an adaptive way.
Mm-hmm. So I know, talking about staying on the topic of preservation, I was looking at your website and there's a you know, there's a way you can apply for a place to be preserved if you feel like this place has a great amount of history and it's, you know, scheduled for demolition. There's a way you can apply for it to be preserved?
Well, you can notify us on our website that there is an asset, a historic building that you feel is in some type of danger. Once a year, we put out a what we call our top 10 endangered sites list. Every May, we publish it. We look at 10 sites within Howard County that in some way are endangered, either by being demolished, being encroached upon by a development, or actually they simply are lacking in some type of funding to help the organization that owns the property. So there's many ways that we can interact with properties that either we find that are endangered, or anyone in the county can provide us with information on sites that they feel are endangered.
Yeah, and you know, speaking of that top 10 list you gave, I was looking on your website, and one of the two sites I was noticed that was on that top 10 list, one was the Harriet Tubman School, and another was the Ellicott City Jail. So tell us a little bit about those two places.
Well, the Harriet Tubman School was a high school. It was strictly for the black students in the county. Once it was closed, it became used as a workshop for the public school system. Mm-hmm. County Executive Kittleman, Bessie Bourdonnais from the Harriet Tubb Foundation, and with PHC, Preservation Howard County, have worked over the past 2 years in arranging a process with the public school system. That building is going to be transferred to the Harriet Tubman Foundation to be used as a African American cultural center.
Wow, that's great.
And a place for events. The Ellicott City Jail was built in the mid-1800s. It's owned by the county. Preservation Howard County would like to see the jail restored and be adaptive to the point that the first floor, which houses the original jail cells, would be used as an interpretive center, and the top two floors would be used as office space, whose rental revenue would be used to sustain the entire building year over year.
Mm, that sounds really great. And, you know, so going back, talking more about the preservations, do you work with other organizations when looking at these sites, like, say, the Howard County Historical Society?
We have worked with the and partnered with the Historic Society. We've also, over the years, partnered with the Howard County Genealogical Society. There is an old crossroads community, the Greater Highland Crossroads Community. We have worked with them on several projects they've had in trying to keep the context of the original crossroads. And, of course, we've dealt with the Harriet Tubman Foundation. And we also deal with Columbia Association and the Columbia Archives. There are several historic assets that are in the Columbia area.
And so just tell us a little bit about something. You're the president of Preservation Howard County. So tell us a little bit about what, you know, some of the duties and, you know, how you what are your duties do in the preservation acts of many of the places you go to?
Well, our group meets six times a year. It's my responsibility to guide the board members through the historic preservation opportunities that present ourselves. I represent the organization through testimonies before the county council, where it is involved with historic preservation legislation. I've also represented the organization with testimonies on bond bills down in the General Assembly each year.
Okay. And so looking sort of at the upcoming year, is there any events you have coming up where people can help become part of the preservation?
We have two events that we do annually. The first one is usually in September. This year it'll be September the 18th. It's our annual Preservationist of the Year Awards, which will be held at the historic Waverly Mansion in Marriottsville. In the month of August, people going to our website will be able to register there to attend that awards. It's in its 16th year. We started it back in 2001. What we do there is we recognize individuals, organizations, and government agencies or government employees who have made significant contributions to historic preservation. Since that time, we have made awards to 62 Howard County residents.
Okay. And so you're talking a little bit about people who contribute to the Preservation Howard County. So tell us about all the ways people can either be a volunteer or become members or contribute, all the ways for Preservation Howard County.
Well, Howard County, the preservation is always will welcome donations. The attendance at our Preservationist of the Year Awards is one way. An annual membership can be made through our website, and any type of support that they can give to historic legislation where it's indicated that we are going to be testifying is most welcome.
Okay, and so also one thing I noticed, say, you know, we're from Howard Community College, so are there any educational opportunities for maybe a college student here or even somebody in the public schools around Howard County?
Not so much with Preservation Howard County, but there are opportunities throughout the county in other organizations. It would be the Historical Society. They have a couple programs for students, which involve tours of Ellicott City. They have what they call a passport opportunity, where people can pick up a passport and they visit different historic sites in the county and register that and then bring it back. The museum, there's opportunities both with the museum. And Columbia Association has a bike about once a year. Each year it's a different route through the Columbia area, which has at least several historic sites where a docent explains the area.
Okay. And then so kind of put you on the spot here a little bit. If you could just narrow it down to one thing, what do you enjoy most about, you know, your job at the Preservation Howard County?
It's involving people in the process of preserving our historic assets and being involved to the point of seeing these assets being preserved and in many cases given an adaptive life.
Okay. And so is there, getting close to my questions here, is there anything I haven't covered or forgot to talk about that you want to bring up now?
Yes, the Preservation Howard County, we were a member of a group of preservationists who gathered back in 2011 to set about writing Howard County's historic preservation plan. It was a plan that had been promised since the 2000 and had yet to be written. For the next 3 years, this group met and actually produced a preservation plan, which the county council passed on in 2013. The other thing is a personal note. I'm a 10th generation descendant of the Dorsey families of Howard County. So there's more of a greater interest in Howard County's history and heritage.
Yeah, and I believe the Dorsey Station, is that?
If you're talking about the rail station,
yes.
It's given the Dorsey name.
Okay.
But you have places like Belmont in Elk Ridge, which is owned by Department of Recreation and Parks. That was a Dorsey home. There's Dorsey Hall up in Dorsey Village in Columbia. There's at least 33 historic homes in the area that were either built for or lived in by the Dorsey family that are still above ground.
Now, it sounds like they've just, you know, I bet you're very proud to be part of that family, just all the contributions they've made throughout history in this county.
Very much so.
Okay, and then so last question I'll have for you is, where are all the places that listeners can go to learn more about Preservation Howard County? I know you have a website, you also have a Facebook page.
Right, those would be the two locations. The website is preservationhowardcounty.org, and on the Facebook, we're just known as Preservation Howard County.
Okay. Since 2000, Preservation Howard County has been in Howard County to increase public awareness and appreciation of our non-renewable sources. I have been talking today to the president of Preservation Howard County, Fred Dorsey, to go in more detail about this organization. Fred, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, it was a pleasure having you. For Oco Journal, I'm Alex Baker, and we'll be right back on Dragon Digital Radio.
1 in 7 Americans will struggle with addiction during their lifetime. Want to know how you can help? Go to heretolisten.com for tips and tools to help turn addiction around. a public service announcement brought to you by the Ad Council.
That's it for our show today. Thanks to our producers and guests, not only for taking the time to speak with us, but also for all you do to make our community a better place. Don't forget to connect with us through social media, our website, and our podcast page, dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And if you'd like to come in and share your story, contact me at moviedo@howardcc.edu, or you can connect with me via Facebook at our page, Dragon Digital Radio, or directly on my page, Cris Oviedo. Stay healthy, happy, positive, and blessed. And remember to lend a helping hand every time you have the chance. Until next month, I am Cris Oviedo.